So good evening. It is really a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to be with people that I've sat with and learned with and consider friends. And also new friends, people who are here for the first time. Tonight's conversation is about spiritual bypass. So first of all, has anyone heard that term before, just by a show of hands? Okay, so a handful. And I'm going to ask in a second what someone thinks it means. But just to acknowledge, this is not a term from the ancient Buddhist suttas. This is a contemporary term, but it hopefully points us back in the same direction. It's the same dharma. It's the same practice we're talking about, no matter what the vocabulary. So does anyone want to venture an opinion about what spiritual bypass might mean? Yeah, Bob.
I think of it as using spiritual concepts to avoid feeling things you don't want to feel.
Yes, so did everyone hear that? That is exactly what we're talking about, and different variations on the theme. Bob said using spiritual concepts or spiritual practice to avoid feeling things we don't want to feel. And then we'll even do some elaborations of that, but yes, that is exactly to the point. So here's a definition that I pulled off the web from someplace I had never seen before called the Be Here Now Network. That's also not a phrase that came out of the ancient suttas. And actually, they use the term spiritual bypassing, but it means the same thing. So they say spiritual bypassing is the use of spirituality to avoid our painful feelings, unmet needs, and unhealed wounds. So you got that. And anyone want to throw out a few thoughts about how we might do this? I mean, this isn't the goal, of course, but you know, how do you think that we use spirituality to avoid our feelings, needs, and wounds? Yeah.
If there's a disaster, for instance, going on in the world, people might say, well, it's just, you know, that's just the way things are, so I don't have to care about it. Or I'm too spiritual to worry about it.
Yeah, great example. Great example. Other thoughts? Yeah.
I know that I will strive for equanimity sometimes, and that in that striving for equanimity and finding myself balanced, I in fact have not. I fight back the stuff that puts you there. In an authentic way,
So I want to make sure that is, you know, an extremely helpful comment. I want to make sure that everyone heard. Striving for equanimity, having an aspiration of equanimity, but in a sense, you didn't use this term, but I'm going to use it to summarize what you said. In a sense, doing it top down, bypassing the steps that we need to actually attain true equanimity.
And then we're suppressing emotion.
Yeah, you know, suppressing the feelings because we haven't come to that place of understanding, which is more likely to yield a deeper or more reliable equanimity. It's not good, bad. It's what ultimately really serves us. And just so I'm going to launch into, you know, a number of ways that this may happen, kind of a mirror for all of us. And I think that, that the examples that have been given will recur in those comments, but. Just to acknowledge at the front end, I mean, it's not entirely accidental that we do this. To acknowledge at the outset that our spiritual tradition, along with many other spiritual traditions, is full of aspirations and ideas that if we misunderstand them, and it would be a misunderstanding, but if we misunderstand them, might seem to minimize the importance of our individual circumstances, including our personal gritty emotions and reactions. So just to give a couple of examples, the first I'll throw out is anatta. Are people familiar with that term? The ancient Pali word that translates basically as not self. People sometimes say no self. Not self, I think, is a little more consistent with the teaching of anatta. So first let's look at what anatta really means. anatta doesn't mean that there's no such thing as a self. I mean, look around. There is such a thing as a self. Jack Kornfield says, very fond of saying, you have to know your own social security number, you know, or whose wallet you get to open. In other words, we still have to live our everyday personal lives skillfully. But anatta is the understanding that everything is conditioned by everything else. Everything is interdependent with everything else. And as such, there's no separate, solid, permanent self that exists independent of everything else. And as a lived insight, you know, Margaret talked about doing the necessary work to get to certain understandings, that can't be bypassed. So as a lived insight, based on practice, based on what we've actually seen in our own hearts and minds, anatta is very useful. I mean, it's helpful to be able to start seeing when we're creating a self or an identity out of things that are not solid or lasting. You know, our bodies, our immediate circumstances, our titles, our latest achievements. I mean, these are all things that we create identities out of. And if we can really see it experientially, right in the moment, how we construct a self, then we can begin to understand the suffering that comes along with doing that. But taken as an abstraction, if we haven't lived it, if we haven't seen it, really seen it, anatta can be misunderstood or distorted to mean something like, there's no self, so why should I pay attention to my trivial personal stuff? Or why should I pay attention to your trivial personal stuff? And similarly, the Buddhist teaching on emptiness, sunyata. This is also an insight about the way everything is conditioned by everything else. Again, that there are no solid, separate, enduring things. And what things are empty of in this teaching is self. So back to anatta. And again, the value of this teaching, very valuable, is as a lived insight. For example, insight into emptiness, seeing the unfolding of conditions, that nothing is stable or permanent or separate, might really help us see our histories and our patterns of suffering with more spaciousness and more compassion and actually more accuracy. But just as with anatta, it's possible to misunderstand or distort emptiness. You know, everything is empty, nothing exists, so I don't have to pay attention to my personal dramas or my personal ethics or obligations. And obviously, nothing could be further from the truth. And I want to acknowledge that the distortions that I've just used as examples are deliberately broad statements, and they might really seem like exaggerations and even caricatures, and to some extent they are. But if we reflect, we may see that we do things that are quite akin to this, either in daily life or in how we view what comes up in meditation. And I really don't think that we do it consciously or deliberately. But we may use our sense of ourselves as people on a spiritual path, or our sense of what a spiritual path is, in a way that diverts us from looking skillfully and carefully at the whole of our mental physical experience. So that goes back to this idea that we use spirituality to avoid experiencing, and especially not experiencing our personal tangles. And how we do this can be quite subtle or very unsubtle. So it's going to vary by person. Maybe we find so much pleasure and satisfaction in meditation and seclusion that we use spiritual practice as somewhat of a sop, and we don't fully engage with our external circumstances, our relationships, our interpersonal challenges, or even our internal challenges, such as personal unhappinesses. Or, and we heard this, you know, from the other corner of the room, maybe we subtly convince ourselves that we feel more equanimity in our lives than we actually do. And, you know, this can really start from a very wholesome place. We intellectually understand the value of cultivating well-being regardless of our circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the teaching on the eight worldly winds. We aspire to live this way, and then we somehow confuse ourselves into thinking that we don't have strong preferences when we actually do. And it's okay, we're just not there yet. Or, this is another variation on the theme. You might not identify it as readily as spiritual bypass, but I think it is. Maybe we find ourselves thinking, if I were really practicing right, I wouldn't be feeling X, Y, or Z. You know, if I were really practicing right, my mind wouldn't be so agitated. If I were really practicing right, I wouldn't be thinking nonstop when I sit down to meditate. I mean, I really know that one well. If I were really practicing right, I wouldn't be jealous of my friend's success, and so on. And in this case, it's not that we're fooling ourselves into thinking that we're calmer than we are, or more equanimous, more filled with equanimity. It's not that we're fooling ourselves into thinking that we're more of whatever form of better we're attached to, but we're still living out a belief that we might not even be aware of, that spiritual practice is supposed to look like this, or I'm supposed to be this, I'm supposed to be like this if I'm a good yogi. And that's excluding important parts of our real experience. Spiritual bypass has also been described as a shadow side of spirituality. Are people, anyone familiar with the term shadow? Do people know what that means? Yeah, I'm seeing some nods and some not. And, you know, essentially it's the hidden or repressed, unwholesome side of a thing. The aspect of a thing that we don't really want to look at. The term comes from the psychologist Carl Jung, and the key idea is that these traits or patterns that we don't want to look at, so we keep them in the shadows, gain power by not being allowed to see the light of day. So spiritual bypass has been described as a shadow side of spirituality. And basically, when we exclude various areas of experience from our understanding of what's, you know, really spiritual, we make them into shadows. So here are some concrete examples of things that some of us might turn into shadows by excluding them from our view of what's spiritual. Sexuality or sexual desire, money, our desire for material things or material comfort, so-called baser emotions like jealousy, competitiveness, envy, resentment, comparing mind, turbulence, clinging, you know, any of the qualities that in Buddhist practice we call the defilements. And each of us has our own variation on the theme. These are just examples. The essential thing is that we sometimes tend to categorize some experiences, consciously or unconsciously, as not worthy of our full attention. And this doesn't necessarily mean that we don't know that these things are happening, the things that we've dismissed as unworthy. You know, as I've already suggested, spiritual bypass takes, you know, as many forms as there are people in the room. So some of us might be blissfully unaware of what's happening. We just go straight through to the bliss aspect of practice, and we don't let ourselves see the so-called uglier sides of ourselves. And this is one form of ignorance, but it's only one. Others of us, perhaps those of us who have a more self-critical bent, might be acutely aware that jealousy is happening, or anger, or desire, but our ingrained reaction to seeing these things is aversion. So we do see them, but then we deflect our attention elsewhere. Maybe we get lost in self-criticism, which can feel very virtuous, but it actually diverts the attention away from a careful and a kind investigation of our reactions. So we're starting to see what the impact, what the consequence is for our practice. Or maybe, and this is a little more subtle, maybe we see these reactions or defilements that we don't like, and we rapidly redirect our attention to something we think is more worthy, like metta or the breath. But again, we miss the opportunity to investigate. So, to interrupt myself and absolutely make sure that I'm not misunderstood, cultivating metta has enormous value. It's one of our core practices. And redirecting attention to the breath is one skill that we use repeatedly as a core skill in our practice. And there are many times when we are redirecting our attention in a variety of circumstances, in sitting on the cushion or in daily life, is the most skillful thing we can do. So I haven't just pulled the rug out from under everything that we've learned here in the years we've been here. But if we consistently relegate greed, hatred, and delusion to the shadows, while the heart of our practice is developing an experiential understanding of greed, hatred, and delusion and how they operate, where does this leave us? Because of course, this meditation tradition is not about the breath. We use the breath, we use an anchor to learn to steady the mind so we can eventually pay careful and close and kind attention to everything that arises. It's only a technique. And the paying careful and close attention to everything that arises is where the real learning happens, the real opening, the real evolution in our practice. So I'm going to read a passage from the book What Really Matters by Tony Schwartz. I'm not reading any suttas tonight. And in this book, in this particular passage, he's talking about what happened in the 1970s when Jack Kornfield came back to the U.S. from Thailand as a young man still in his 20s after many years of Buddhist practice, including ordination as a Buddhist monk. So the author says, very quickly he, that's Jack, came to a painful and disappointing realization. The deep understandings and the extraordinary states of clarity and well-being that he had experienced in meditation did not translate easily into worldly life in America. My meditation had helped me very little with relationships, he wrote. I was still emotionally immature, acting out the same painful patterns of blame and fear, acceptance and rejection that I had before my Buddhist training. Only the horror was that now I was beginning to see these patterns more clearly. The worst of both worlds, right? I had used the strength of my mind in meditation to suppress painful feelings. And all too often, I didn't even recognize that I was angry, sad, grieving, or frustrated until a long time later. I had very few skills for dealing with my feelings or engaging on an emotional level or living wisely with my friends and loved ones. So, I mean, in case you thought it was just you, Jack is one of the giants of 20th and 21st century Buddhist teaching. Here's another quotation from Jack from an article called Even the Best Meditators Have Old Wounds to Heal. It's a longish passage, but I think it says a lot that's worth hearing. For most people, meditation practice doesn't do it all. Now, this is directly from the voice of Jack. For most people, meditation practice doesn't, quote, do it all, unquote. At best, it's one important piece of a complex path of opening and awakening. I used to believe that meditation led to the higher, more universal truths, and that psychology, personality, and our own, quote, little dramas, unquote, were a separate lower realm. I wish it worked that way, but experience and the non-dual nature of reality don't bear it out. If we are to end suffering and find freedom, we can't keep these two levels of our lives separate. Mindfulness works only when we are willing to direct attention to every area of our suffering. This doesn't mean getting caught in our personal histories, as many people fear, but learning how to address them so that we can actually free ourselves from the big and painful blocks of our past. Such healing work is often best done in a therapeutic relationship with another person. So he's saying what we're doing here, as valuable as it is not the whole story. He goes on to say meditation and spiritual practice can easily be used to suppress and avoid feeling or to escape from difficult areas of our lives. And then what he says here, I think, is so compassionate, really getting to the heart of it, really understanding why we do this. He says, our sorrows are hard to touch. Many people resist the personal and psychological roots of their suffering. There is so much pain in truly experiencing our bodies, our personal histories, our limitations. It can even be harder than facing the universal suffering that surfaces in sitting. We fear the personal and its sorrow because we have not learned how it can serve as our practice and open our hearts. So, in the context of this talk, I've also been looking at how spiritual practice manifests in my life, and manifests in lots of places in my life, but just, you know, to give a couple of personal examples. So my particular mind tilts toward aversion. And as a little kind of backdrop, we often talk about the Buddhist personality types. It's a summary way of talking about whether our minds are more influenced by greed, meaning wanting, hatred, which is aversion, pushing things away, or delusion, primarily meaning confusion. And obviously all of us manifest all of these qualities, but we'll generally tilt most heavily in one or another of these directions. And I own being an aversive type. I'm more likely to push things away or to see what I don't like. And as an aversive type, I'm not so likely to get lost in blissing out. That's not my personal variation generally on a spiritual bypass. I'm more likely to notice unpleasant experiences and reactions. And when I notice these things, I don't reflexively just welcome the opportunity to look at them kindly and carefully. I mean, often what comes up is judgment. I shouldn't be feeling this. If I were practicing the right way, it wouldn't look like this, it would look like that. Mm-hmm. And of course, while I'm busy judging my experience, I'm not simultaneously paying kind and careful attention to the experience. I mean, almost by definition, that's not possible. Mm-hmm. But, and certainly over time, I think this has shifted with this practice, that sometimes when I can catch a glimpse of the reactivity in action, I'm actually able to bring some compassion to the situation. I might even be able to recognize with a little bit of humor that the mind's behavior doesn't fit my theories, and that actually leaves more room, more space to sit with the experience in a way that's less judgmental and allows more genuine awareness of what's going on. And when I talk about what's going on, I mean the experience, the actual experience, which does not require words, the body, the emotion, even the experience of thinking, what the thinking feels like, as opposed to getting lost in the contents of the thoughts. So another form of spiritual bypass that I notice in myself is one of the traps that I mentioned earlier in the talk, that I can subtly, and another member of our group, you know, flagged something similar, that I can subtly convince myself that I'm experiencing things that I think a good meditator is supposed to be experiencing. Mm-hmm. So to give a very concrete example, one time when I was on retreat, I was having a difficult time with a judgmental mind. You know, you're on retreat and you're not distracting yourself with a lot of other things that we distract ourselves with in our lives, and so stuff has a way of arising, you know, and making itself known. And I had pictures in my mind about what I, quote unquote, was supposed to be like on retreat, and I was judging my practice for not living up to these images and feeling discouraged. And when you're on retreat, you have an opportunity to have what are called practice interviews. You get to have one-on-one chats with the teachers about how it's going. So I had a practice interview with one of the teachers, and one of the first things I came, and I sort of felt like I was being a very good yogi here, one of the first things I said to the teacher was, well, of course I understand that we're not practicing to feel better. And the teacher said, yes, we are. We all want to experience well-being. And it was a very funny moment. It was actually an extremely funny moment because I had been trying so hard to be a good meditator, a good yogi, that I said something with an entirely straight face that wasn't at all true, but that matched up with my theory of what a serious practitioner would think and feel. And of course, I was fooling myself. I wasn't fooling the teacher. So before we just turn it over to the group, which we're almost ready to do, I'm just going to summarize a little bit, you know, what the problems might be, some of the problems with using our spiritual practice or our spiritual identity to turn away from our feelings, our history, and our personal issues. And when I say what's the problem, it's not good or bad, it's how does it misserve us? How does it direct us away from something that, a way of looking and feeling that can be a lot more nourishing and ultimately provide a lot more lasting satisfaction? So, and of course, the problem, quote-unquote, with doing this is going to be different depending on what we're doing, but here are some of the things that I think are issues. First of all, it can leave parts of us, major parts of us, unloved and unexplored. It perpetuates the delusion that we're not good enough the way we are. It keeps us from exploring the shadow side of experience. And ironically, that keeps the shadow powerful. Now, the next one is for me, if I were using yellow highlighter, I would just be yellow highlighting all over this, because to me, this is the crux. I think it really perpetuates a delusion about what practice is. And I think for those of us who have been practicing for a long time, and for those of us who are relatively new to practice, we've already seen that practice is a very gradual process, and the pay dirt is in being present with our experience as it actually is. Shantideva, in The Way of the Bodhisattva, which is a great Mahayana Buddhist text, says that we find, quote, a precious gem within a mound of filth. A precious gem within a mound of filth. I think this means we have to be able to look at the filth. And, of course, the big idea behind our practice tradition, it's called insight meditation for a reason, is that insight, actually seeing the machinations of the mind, is what frees us. Seeing how the mind leads itself into and out of dukkha, which is translated as suffering, but possibly means more like unsatisfactoriness. Actually seeing, experiencing, with great awareness, the patterns of suffering until we finally weary of them and lose some of our grip. So if we're avoiding seeing those things and that's where the pay dirt is in our practice, we might not get the full benefit of our practice. I think that various kinds of spiritual bypass, and Jack's quotations really alluded to this, ignore that even if we find bliss in meditation, we eventually have to come back to earth and deal with our lives, our real circumstances. And these various forms of spiritual bypass can also perpetuate the illusion or the dogma, and it can be a dogma, that meditation should be able to address all our problems. And that can prevent us from using other practical resources that may improve the quality of our lives. I mean, I'm talking about resources all over the map, ranging from therapy to financial planning to taking action in the political arena, whatever is suitable for the particular person in the particular situation. But we have to acknowledge that there's not only one game called insight meditation practice. And I think also, in a sense, that spiritual bypass may be a form of doubt, and doubt in the sense of the hindrance of doubt. Because if we don't let ourselves pay honest attention to our real gritty experiences, we're holding back. We're not giving ourselves fully to what practice can offer. So before I just, you know, turn it over and invite a free-for-all, I'm going to end the talk with a poem that may be familiar to many of you. In fact, it may be so familiar to many of you that I had to ask myself whether it really needed to find its way into one more Dharma talk. But I think it was so appropriate to the subject matter that the answer was yes. So this is The Guest House by Rumi, translated by Coleman Barks. This being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be cleaning you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. But don't take that as too much of a should either. So we have plenty of time now for your questions, reflections, personal examples, you know, anything that you want to share or inquire into.